Survivor 46 is here, and so is On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast, and we have a twist this season. The winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares, will be joining us every week.
We're going behind the scenes of the biggest moments, the how and the why things happen, and the strategy and analysis you can only get from someone like me, a Survivor winner.
Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
What's Helter Skelter got to do with knifing somebody?
Seems this world got you down. You're feeling bad vibrations round. Well, open your eyes, girl. Look at me.
Look at
I'm gonna
me.
Show you how it ought to be.
My guest today is British journalist and writer Ivor Davis, who some of you may remember being on the show previously when we did a dedicated show on the Charles Manson connection to the Beatles, such as it is. And the reason I brought in Ivor is because if you look at his career as a English-born journalist who came to the States initially in 1964 to accompany the Beatles on tour and eventually became the stationed reporter out on the West Coast covering the entertainment beat for his newspaper, he was exceedingly well-placed at every step of the way to witness as this supreme fly on the wall these moments that we as fans of the Beatles are interested in, be they the first tour, which was amazing, in September of 1964. He was there in New York when Bob Dylan showed up at their hotel, and you know what ensued there. He was there in 1965 for the follow-up tour when the Beatles went to meet Elvis. that in itself is two incredible events. But he was on the West Coast come 1969, summer of 69, 50 years ago, when the Tate-LaBianca murders took place. And he was one of the first reporters on the scene who not only was covering it for his newspaper, but also got the inside scoop, as it were, through a series of circumstances that took him to the Spahn Ranch, where he was able to interview present day at the time and former members of the Manson family and get some insider information that was turned into a book called Five to Die, the first on the Manson case, published before the trial got going, that was used, as we discussed on the show previous, by prosecutor Vincent Bugliosi as sort of the blueprint for the prosecution. So this is a guy who's seen it all, is a brilliant writer, great friend, and I will catch you up since the last time he appeared on the show. He had published a couple books. One was Ladies and Gentlemen, The Penguins, which is a book for children on a musical group resembling you-know-who. But currently out, just out, is his brand new book, which is a sort of updating of the 50th anniversary of Five to Die. But it's expanded, and he can discuss that, called Manson Exposed, A Reporter's 50-Year Journey into Madness and Murder. Look for it. It is just out now. He's been a very busy man, giving tons of interviews at this not only 50th anniversary of the events on Cielo Drive, but also concurrent with the brand new Quentin Tarantino film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which was the first thing I wanted to ask him about because he did see a screening of it. And as a guy who is a witness to the events, who better to ask about it and get his take on the movie? Welcome back, Ivor.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction. Can you go on the road with me when I do my book signings, please?
I am so there. And I would be remiss not to mention the title of your Beatles memoir, being on tour with them, which is The Beatles and Me on Tour.
Thank you.
Published, I believe, 2014.
Correct.
Great book.
Thank you. Well, so where should we start? We got so much to talk about, Robert, you know.
Yes. That's why I love having you here.
Yeah.
So I will start with the immediate. You just saw the film. And what was your impression of it?
Well, I love the movie, but I should warn anybody who hasn't seen it. It's called Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which is a fairy story, a Grimm's fairy story, because it's kind of comic book and it's funny and it's well worth seeing. And the performances, I don't know if you agree with me, I thought Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio were brilliant. I thought they were the new Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid playing together. Am I exaggerating? You saw the film, Robert. Weren't they spectacular?
I did see it, and I think your characterization is spot on. That was, in fact, I was kind of reminded of Paul Newman and Robert Redford when I was watching the film.
Yeah. The point is, Mr. Tarantino twists history to suit himself. And in this movie, he does it quite brilliantly and funnily, so that when you come out of the movie, which is, after all, it's about Sharon Tate, it's about Manson, the mass murderer, you actually, believe it or not, come out smiling, only because of the magic that Mr. Tarantino has wrought in the movie. It's about 2 hours and 45 minutes. It's fascinating. I love the way he recaptured the ambiance, the music, the spirit of 1969. I mean, he did it so brilliantly. The camera work is great. The performances are terrific. And the final kicker will leave you in amused shock. Yeah, that's all I'm going to say. One other thing. I saw the film with a judge friend of mine who is a Beatles fan. He came out and he was a bit disgusted. But then when we started talking, he realized, look at the title of the film. Do you expect truth or do you expect Mr. Tarantino, who after all, in the movie Inglourious Basterds, killed Hitler? So what do you expect?
It's not a documentary, folks.
No, it's not a documentary, so don't go in. You yourself, Robert, what would you say hit you about the film? I mean, what about the guy, the English actor who played Steve McQueen? He was brilliant, wasn't he?
Yeah, the guy from Billions and Homeland.
Yeah.
And right off the top of my head, I can't remember his name. But yeah, you know exactly who we're talking about.
Yeah.
I thought it's funny. It never occurred to me before how much he resembles Steve McQueen until I saw him cast as him. And it's like, oh my God, of course he does.
Oh.
So that was brilliant.
Yeah. And what about Margot Robbie? Sweet, a bit Barbie dollish, but I mean, Margot Robbie was excellent as Sharon. And, you know, I think he did, all the people that played in that movie were just superlative. So no wonder the film has earned more money in the first week for a Tarantino movie than ever before for a Tarantino movie.
Yeah, and what was interesting to me was, as you said, Margot Robbie's performance, she brought a real humanity to Sharon Tate, who, if she's known to people today, it's because of the event of her murder, her brutal murder, and not as the living person she was to the people who knew her, who you, in fact, interviewed at some point, I think the year before.
Yeah, you know, and also I wondered about the film when I first saw it, or before I saw it, because it said that Sharon's sister,
Deborah,
gave thumbs up to the film. And I thought, oh my God, how is that possible? Mm-hmm. Because everybody who knows the murders knows the gory truth. But this is not truth. This is fiction. This is a fairy story or fairy tale.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing I noticed, too, is just that, and I would expect no less from Tarantino, but the incredible effort going into capturing precise details, everything from the car that they drove up in to the gun, the long-barreled gun, and just different things that are fact-checkable along the way, he absolutely nailed.
And, you know, one other thing I want to add, because as you know, Robert, I went to the Spahn Ranch and spent several days there. In the movie, he recreates the Spahn Ranch with unerring accuracy. I mean, I thought I was back there. And the scene in the movie in which Brad Pitt goes to the Spahn Ranch is a knockout. It's kind of scary, chilling. It reminded me, I think there was a movie, for those who like movies, like Village of the Damned. The Manson girls were zombies, and it was scary. I mean, what did you think?
Yeah, I thought that was the most chilling part of the movie because you didn't know how it was going to play out. You knew that part of the movie was fiction, but you also knew that, well, this is based on absolutely real people, and what's going to happen here? Who's going to survive this telling of the story?
Yeah, just that scene in the Spahn Ranch kind of makes makes you shudder and makes you think, oh my God, what has he got himself into? And it was a bit like that because I was there and I saw it. And the way they recreated the ramshackle dirt. Anyway.
And then the cars everywhere and the buggies and horses. Yeah. You're very descriptive in your book describing that whole scene. And that might be a good pivot point. If there's anything else you wanted to say about the movie, we can talk about that. But the Spahn Ranch thing, that I would have expected to be the point that you would have focused in on, because that was really your entree into that world.
I mean, I thought, you know, as I say, we may be spending too much time on the movie, but when I went to the Spahn Ranch, I expected to see a movie set ranch, and it was a dump. It was a real bloody dump. And, you know, there were flies, there were horses, there was decrepit cars, and that's all that was captured. And that's the only way millions of people will see what the Spahn Ranch looked like. It was not idyllic. It was a real, as I say, a real dump.
Yeah.
And that's where when I tell you when it was, it was December 1969. As soon as I heard that Charles Manson was the accused mastermind of the murders of Sharon Tate and the others, I went to the Spahn Ranch and met and talked with many members of the family who were not involved in the murders. And that's when they told me the amazing story about Manson breaking the brains. I mean, absolutely brainwashing his followers to believe, and this is where you and I believe that it was the Beatles' White Album music that inspired the murders. I mean, how ridiculous does that sound?
Yeah, it was crazy. But when you had these people that were the classic cult followers that were, as you described, brainwashed, that were so susceptible to a powerful influence that was able to connect dots and reach them at this point of vulnerability where he could preach from the Beatles hymnal, as it were, in a way that they were able to relate to as young people who undoubtedly had been Beatle fans at some point prior to their journey that took them to Spahn Ranch. So it was something that he, with great shrewdness and cleverness, was able to push all the right buttons and get these people to fall under his power, as it were.
Yeah, well, what he did, and what I heard at the ranch, was what he actually did was he played the White Album 40 times a day to the followers, and they listened, and somehow that kind of guard their brains. And as you so well put it, it became a Beatle hymnal. And they actually believed, because Charlie fed them mescaline and LSD and all the rest of it, they believed that the Beatles were sending these secret messages to Charlie. I mean, how crazy is that? And not only were they sending these messages, as you know, and as many of your listeners know, the lyrics of the Beatles songs like Helter Skelter and Pig Ears and Revolution were messages to say there was going to be a black and white race war and everybody was going to kill each other except for Charlie and the girls, because they would escape in their dune buggies to Death Valley, an underground city where they would live until peace was restored and all that hokum. I mean, come on, where are we? Are we all on mescaline? are you going to swallow that crap? They did.
Yeah.
And so did the jury. Yeah. And so did the jury.
And so did Bugliosi in using that as his laying out of motivation.
Bugliosi, I mean, this was, look, I mentioned this in my book, but I'm sitting in the courtroom, July 1970, and suddenly Bugliosi stands up in his three-piece suit and his tie, and he launches his opening statement about what I've just said. The Beatles made them do it. The Beatles messages. And I thought to myself, Vince, you must be on peyote or whatever, because all the craziness. I mean, but let me just say one other thing, and I'm sorry to ramble on. I guess what happened was Vince realized that how could he get a conviction? If he got a conviction for the real reason that Charlie sent him out to murder, which was to put the cops off the trail of Bobby Beausoleil. Bobby Beausoleil was there with Charlie's right-hand man, left-hand man. Bobby Beausoleil was in jail for killing the musician Gary Hinman on July 27, 1969, 2 weeks before the Tate murders. Bobby was in jail facing the death penalty if convicted. And Charlie said, I wonder what I can do to get Bobby out. And he cooked up this double murder, August 9th, August 10th. I mean, that's the real reason, to get Bobby out of the prison and make the cops believe that a gang of black militant Panthers were out there killing people. And so poor old Bobby Beausoleil must be as innocent as the snow, the pure white snow. And somehow in Charlie's warped mind, the cops would say, Bobby, you're not guilty of Gary Hinman's murder. Why don't you go home? I mean, it's all crazy, but there it is.
Yes, and that's a point that should be underscored, is that there is this additional layer of motivation beyond what we've talked about on a previous show. It gets talked about the whole Manson as aspiring rock star, gets disappointed by producer Terry Melcher, who lived at that house on Cielo Drive and wants to send a message. That was almost sort of incidental of why he picked that particular house. But as you say, the murder of Gary Hinman, which had taken place just a couple of weeks before, and his right-hand guy is in jail, and Manson is coming up with this idea that if it appears to the police that they've got the wrong guy because another murder takes place with similar footprints of what happened at Gary Hinman's place, that they realize they had the wrong guy. And if you can make it look like black militants did it, all the better.
You've summed it up perfectly. But Robert, how crazy is that? I mean, you've got to be demented to say these dumb cops are going to think other people did it, and they're going to, here's the key, you can go home now, Bobby. I mean, get away. Amazing.
Manson wouldn't have had any way of knowing this, but in fact, as you lay out in the book, it's like at the scene of these respective crimes, you've got different agencies in charge of the investigations who are not talking to each other. So things that, dots that could have been connected much sooner go unconnected because they're not sharing intelligence.
Exactly. And that was the reason, exactly the way beautifully put, the dots were never connected between the LAPD and the LA Sheriff's, who were completely separate entities. Even they operated within a quarter of a mile each other in different buildings. They never talked to each other. It's what they call police rivalry. I mean, I'm not going to tell you what I'm doing unless you tell me what you're doing. I mean, it's crazy, but that's what happened. And so nobody connected the dots. And nobody thought that Hinman was connected to the Sharon Tate, was connected to the LaBianca murders. But Manson told his killers, when you go to the Sharon Tate house, when you go to the LaBianca house, leave the witchy signs. Witchy signs meaning blood painted on the wall with signs like Helter Skelter, Pig Ears, War, in the
rise.
Victim's blood. Mm-hmm. And so if you put them, if you and I put Case A, Hinman, Case B, Sharon Tate, KC LaBianca, put it in a computer today, the computer would flash similarity, similarity, similarity. They never did it.
Right. And it should be pointed out to people that don't know or haven't read your book yet that at the Gary Hinman murder scene, it was written in his blood, political piggy on the wall.
Correct. Yes. So Charlie said, do that at these various crime scenes. And one other little niblet, one other little gem or whatever. After the LaBianca murders, Charlie Manson stole victim Rosemary LaBianca's purse with her credit card in. And this is the way his thinking went. He said to Linda Kasabian, who was one of his followers and who never took part in the actual killings, he said, let's go to a black neighborhood and you dump the purse and the credit cards in the restroom of a gas station in a black neighborhood. And she did. And Charlie's thinking was, there's going to be somebody, a black person, picking up the purse and finding the credit cards, using the credit cards, and the cops would say, aha, we've tracked it down to these black guys in this black neighborhood. Well, the problem was they dumped the purse in a restroom, in a gas station, in Sylmar, and believe it or not, Sylmar was not a black neighborhood. So another little wrinkle to this Byzantine story that just keeps on going.
Unbelievable. So to go back to Spahn Ranch a second, when you hit upon that as being the gateway to really digging in and getting all this information that nobody knew yet, the first person you run into is Squeaky Fromm of later notoriety, but also the two guys who just by pure happenstance happened to be there, who had quit the family, but happened to be coming back to visit once the news started circulating about what was going on with Charlie and the members that had been arrested. And they just wanted to check in and see what was going on. And you happened upon them at the same time. And they're the ones, they're the disaffected ex-family members who are completely willing to spill their guts to you about what they know and what a dangerous man Manson is.
Beautifully put. That's exactly what happened. I mean, because when I spoke to Squeaky, she said to me, oh, Charlie is a misunderstood guy. He just wants the earth pure and the water clean and all that stuff. And, you know, this murder stuff is phooey. And then I sat down with Brooks Poston and Paul Watkins, the guys who'd escaped, and they were just dying to talk. And they were the ones, Danny DiCarlo was another guy who was on the ranch, and they were the ones that for a couple of days had me entranced with the story about Manson brainwashing them about the Beatle music, the revolution, escaping to the desert, bloody revolution between blacks and whites. And I actually, particularly when they told me the Beatle connection, I mean, I, as I mentioned a few moments ago, sat there in shock and total disbelief. Because, come on, I knew the Beatles, I knew their music did not incite murder. And I wasn't about to say you're full of crap, because as a journalist, you sit there and you listen and you tape record and you take notes and you think these guys are in la-la land. But that was the story. And I couldn't believe my ears or my eyes. And these guys were dying to talk. And Paul Watkins and Brooks both testified at the murder trials. And just an added footnote here. Paul Watkins became a prosecution witness in the trial of Manson. Paul Watkins was then considered a traitor. And I knew that some of the Manson girls out of jail could wreak revenge. And Paul Watkins was asleep in a trailer after the murder trial, or just after the murder trial began. And suddenly he woke up and the whole trailer was ablaze and he got out alive with third-degree burns. There is no doubt that Manson had told the girls, get rid of this guy, because then he can't testify. I mean, there is so much example of that. One other thing which involves me. In 1970, as you pointed out, I wrote a very quick book called Five to Die, which is no longer in print. Squeaky knew that. And when I actually arrived on the first day of the trial, Squeaky was sitting on the sidewalk outside the Hall of Justice in downtown L.A., she saw me, she'd met me, she knew I wrote this book, derogatory about Charlie and the family, and she sweetly said to me, hi, Ivor, do you know what it feels like to have a sharp knife put down your throat? To be honest with you, I was a little bit shocked. She said it so sweetly, it still didn't remove the shock and the horror. And I raced to the phone, called my wife, and said, look, do me a favor, move our house. take my one-year-old daughter with you because Squeaky has just had a conversation with me and I'm scared. And so that is the kind of thing, the atmosphere, the menace that the little girls, little harmless girls had who were not in jail, but they were still devoted to the Manson propaganda. And it was a scary time for everyone.
It's unbelievable that these people who had come from more or less conventional backgrounds, once they fell under the sway of Manson, could be turned to sociopathy so easily.
Look, Sandra Good had a very wealthy family, and she was the most devoted Manson family member. I think she's still devoted to the memory of Charlie. And she was a girl that was getting, she was a trust fund kid. She was getting like a lot of money in 1969. And she turned all the money that she got from her father, trust fund kid, over to Charlie. And he spent it on drugs. And he's paying some of the Spahn Ranch electricity bills. So these young women, as you said, came from pretty well-to-do homes. They ran away from home for a variety of reasons. They came to the Spahn Ranch. They fell under Charlie Manson's spell because Charlie to them, as you know, and as all your listeners know, was mesmerizing. And for these young women, sad young women, tragic young women, Charlie was their father, their Jesus Christ, their lover, and their dictatorial boss. And they just did whatever Charlie said. And Charlie said murder, they did murder.
Unbelievable.
With a clock that always said 12:30. Young girls have come into the canyon, and in the mornings I can see them walking. I can no longer keep my blind.
As you point out in the book, it was something that is an interesting aspect that I don't think a lot of people have commented on, but you certainly would have been aware of it, was that at the same time the trial is going on in the late summer of 1970, John Lennon is out there doing primal scream therapy with Arthur Janov, which is something, had the defense known that, they could have called him to the witness stand to ostensibly bolster their case, but it would have just blown up everything.
I know that the prosecution didn't know, and neither did the defense. But as you said, John and Yoko were doing this primal therapy very, very low-key, very secretively in L.A. at the time of the trial. And I know that because I interviewed Janov after John and Yoko left. So every day, John and Yoko would get a limo car to the treatment center in Los Angeles, and they followed the trial. They knew what was going on. And I know that if any of the defense lawyers had known that John and Yoko, particularly John, was in L.A., they would have subpoenaed him and they would have tried to get him in court, which would have created, I mean, can you imagine John Lennon taking the witness stand and swearing to tell the truth and the whole truth and nothing but the truth? What it would have done would have probably, I'm just guessing, and you tell me what you think, if John Lennon had testified to what he said to me years later, that this was a load of old malarkey, that my lyrics were not insightful to murder, it would have actually probably served the defense best because it would have thrown things into chaos. John Lennon would have testified that the whole prosecutorial theme would have been blown out of the water and Manson might have been acquitted. I mean, you tell me, if John got on the stand and said, look, the lyrics did not mean anything, doesn't that sabotage the district attorney's case?
Well, yeah, if Bugliosi, having chosen that tack of the gospel of the Beatles, was the primary cause of his murders, that's a pretty weak foundation, especially when it can be undermined by the co-author of some of those songs directly in court. And you describe in the book during the so-called Lost Weekend, when you did have a sit down with John, with Mei Peng, and talking about this very subject, which at first he was reluctant to discuss, but then once he got going, as you describe in the book, he points out, what did he think of revolution? Where he's talking about peace and count me out if you want violence. How did Manson miss that point?
Yeah. You're an expert in this field because you know the lyrics, and you, last time we talked, came up with other comments from the Beatles about this cockamamie crazy theory. Do you remember, do you recall, Robert, what you said? I mean, the other Beatles were all shocked to horror and just blew the theory into smithereens.
Oh, yeah. There was during an anthology in the 90s that they all got asked about it, and Paul was appalled. I mean, naturally, Helter Skelter, having, as you described, reading the lyrics, nothing whatsoever to do with anything violence, although apparently he ripped the line out of it, I'm coming down fast, or it's coming down fast. And yeah, that nicely played into what he was describing as the coming race war. But Ringo and certainly George, who was man of peace to his core, they were all shocked at this, but it was sort of a natural development of what had been going on from day one, of people drawing these crazy interpretations from their songs and things that are wildly out of left field from their original intents when they were crafting this material. You see a more benign example of that in the documentary John Lennon Imagine, where that guy Kurt Claudio shows up at his house in Tittenhurst and Ascot, and is convinced that John Lennon had been sending him messages through the Beatle music, although he was not incited to commit mass murder.
Yeah, well, here's the problem. I think the real reason why Manson did the killings was to get Bobby Beausoleil out of jail. If he tried to go on that basis during the trial, I think Manson would have been acquitted, because the idea of setting up two murders to get a pal out of prison is so far-fetched that any jury would have said, you know, come off it, Vince. You've got to be crazy to come up with this. So I always say, in a way, Bugliosi's, the ends justified the means. So he used this theory and he got his outcome. He got the guilty verdict. But one other thing, the way Manson behaved in court during the 9-month-long trial, he would have been convicted of anything, because every time he showed the jury that he was in total control of the girls. When he sang, they sang. When he said something, they kind of mimicked him so that the jury could see Charlie Manson is in total control of these girls. And so whatever you say, if he was in total control of the girls, he must have been in total control of their get out and kill. So I think if Bugliosi had gone for the real reason, Manson might not have been convicted. So you take your pot, you take your shot, and you hope that the score will become a winner.
Right. And maybe the Beatles wouldn't have this taint upon the White Album that has endured ever since Bugliosi and Kurt Gentry wrote that book using a Beatles song, yes, as a title, and then the subsequent film. And so despite our efforts on this show and the previous one in your books to disassociate the Beatles from this connection and having any validity, still an awful lot of people walking around thinking there's something to it.
I think so. Now, the interesting thing is, jumping back to the beginning, kind of bookending what we were talking about, Robert, right at the beginning about the Tarantino film. Interestingly enough, Mr. Manson barely has a walk-on part.
Yes.
And I hope I'm not spoiling it for those who want to see Manson. But if you recall, Manson has more, it's probably less than 30 to 45 seconds on screen in a 2-hour and 45-minute movie. So does that mean Quentin Tarantino was dismissing Manson as an aberration? Possibly. But if you expect to see the movie, the reason for Manson, this is not Manson's film, is it?
No, not at all. But he makes a compelling focus for the media back in 69, 70. We've got especially that Life magazine cover of that police photo. He looks like the devil incarnate. And
that's right. I mean,
it's old media, it's old papers, it's old books, it's old magazines. And to make Bugliosi look all the more heroic, he has to build up his nemesis.
Oh, Yeah, the amazing thing is, and you tell me if you agree with what I'm about to say, Robert, if Manson had been executed in the San Quentin gas chamber in the early 70s, instead, of course, the death penalty was abolished and Manson went to prison for life. If Manson had been executed, then do you think you and I would be having this conversation?
No, it would have been the end of the story, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
he built up mystique in the decades to follow because the media would keep approaching him and he'd give interviews over time. And he was able to build this cult status that legions of people, especially once the internet came along, you know, building sites and all this fandom to him.
Yeah, the intriguing point is this, I think, that millions of Americans knew about Manson and they thought, my God, I wouldn't want this guy in my living room. And then over a period of 20 years, Manson came into their living rooms.
Right.
And how did he do it? He appeared on Diane Sawyer, Primetime, Tom Snyder, Ron Reagan Jr., Geraldo Rivera, and on and on. And whenever he appeared in a Primetime interview, the ratings went through the roof because Charlie was an actor.
Yeah.
Charlie gave them what they wanted. He was the bogeyman incarnate. You wanted a performance, he gave you a performance. I mean, look at those shows. You can see them on YouTube. I mean, he is a brilliant entertainer. And as a result of that, Charlie didn't become more famous than the Beatles, but he certainly became more famous than Jack the Ripper, particularly thanks to primetime television.
Right. He studied his Dale Carnegie well in prison.
That's exactly it. And you bring up a brilliant point. He did study the Dale Carnegie book when he was in prison, and he stole many of the facets, the key points, and he used it, and he used it to great effect. And Dale Carnegie and Charlie Manson, that seems like an odd twosome, doesn't it?
Right. But not, yeah. That's an aspiring cult leader. That's your textbook.
That's right. There it is. Well, who do you owe your success to, Charlie? Dale Carnegie, of course, silly question. I mean, you know, it's a story. It's so crazy that we couldn't make it up, could we?
No, we couldn't. It took a Tarantino to come along and return it to its grim fairy tale origins.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, as I say, you know, nobody would believe it. And there are kids today, as I say, who don't know about Manson. And the reason I wrote the book in the first place was I was visiting my daughter in the Pacific Northwest and two guys came in. They were fixing the kitchen and we talked about crime. And I asked them, do you know who Charles Manson is? And they said, he's the guy who was railroaded. He wanted to clean the air and all that stuff. And they locked him up for a murder he never committed. So there it is. There's people out there who think Charlie is okay. He wasn't okay.
Well, you're doing your good work. You're doing your part in leading people to the truth. And that's commendable after 50 years. Now, what would you say in this new volume that you've had 50 years to add to the story? What is it that's new that you're bringing to the table in this book that's just adding further to the narrative you started back with Five to Die?
Well, I think there's my interviews, of course, with Roman Polanski in Paris. There's the revelations of my interview with Doris Day's son, Terry Melcher, in Carmel, California. I've spoken to a lot of new people over the last 2 years to include in the book. And I've had a chance to update. I mean, I spoke to Charlie's prison guards and the guy and got another picture of this guy in prison because he spent most of his life in prison. And one is able to synthesize it all and come up with the final theory about that it wasn't the Beatles' fault. And don't even bring them into it, please, because that's a load of phooey. I mean, the Beatles did involve themselves, were involved by Manson and the family. My book about the Beatles covered 5 weeks with the Beatles, a little bit longer. This book covers 50 years. So I start on day one when I was involved, and I finish up with the funeral of Manson, which was also a circus. And then everybody likes to know where are they now. So we've got that. And I could have kept writing for another year because so many side alleys took me to so many different points. And when I was able, for example, to put together all the people who died mysteriously, maybe on orders from Manson, maybe pure coincidence, it just keeps on going. And I think with this book, I think I want to stop, keep on going. And I think, right, finish to this. But unfortunately, we're going to hear more. And that's the nature of the Manson beast.
It's got legs and it keeps going. So,
right.
I commend you for this book. It's thoroughly engrossing read, and we could talk about it all day, but this is something about the Beatles, and I think we've covered that aspect nicely. So I will again mention to readers that you can find it now. It's newly published, Manson Exposed, A Reporter's 50-Year Journey into Madness and Murder. And would you recommend Ivor Davis Books as your sort of one stop for all your work to...
The reason IvorDavisBooks.com is worth going to is, number one, you can read more than you ever wanted to know about me and realize that, really, I was thinking today, I think I'm the only living journalist today who's still around who covered the Manson story from day one until today. So it's my personal story of the beginning, the middle, and the end. And you can also get the book on Amazon. But as I say, if you want to read about my journey, go on to my IvorDavisBooks.com. And it's always a pleasure, Robert, to talk to you, because one of the great things is you have such vast knowledge of the case from almost A to Z, and particularly the music, the Beatles, and that whole crazy, crazy chapter in the middle of, as 1969-70 finished and the 60s came to an end.
There's so much going on at the time. The whole Paul is Dead story, the murder at Altamont with the Rolling Stones concert.
Yeah.
It was definitely things taking a dark turn there.
Yeah, but let me ask you this. Here's a perfect example of fiction. You probably followed the Paul is Dead thing closer than I did, but when I saw Paul in San Diego 3 weeks ago, and it was nice reminiscing with him. But the idea of that Paul died and they've got a doppelganger and slipped him in is total, utter fiction, surely. I mean, what's your take on that? Why? What happened?
Well, this is something that is fascinating to explore in terms of why do people believe in conspiracy theories generally. I think I see them more getting mainstream nowadays than they did back in 1969. Why are the people walking around claiming that the Earth is flat and that the moon landings were staged? You know, why is such a strong belief system and websites and books devoted to propagating these theories? You know, you go back to the 60s, and I don't have a particular theory on the Paul is Dead one other than the circumstantial situation, Paul dropping out of public sight in the fall of 69 with what's going on inwardly with the Beatles, and he's up in his Scottish farm and not showing up at Apple. Abbey Road comes out, and then people start connecting these dots, which must have happened really fast, because it was by October 12th that Russ Gibbs, the Detroit DJ, has got people calling him up, you know, talking about the clues that were found in the Beatles songs and in their album packaging. But the story actually had started on college campuses a little bit before that and just caught fire really fast. But then just as quickly, it seemed to go away once the Life magazine reporters went down to Campbellton and tracked down Paul and put him on the cover and ran that story. So, but it was very intense. And to this day, there are these people putting together videos that swear that no, he really died, folks. And this is how it happened. And this is how the replacement happened. So, you know, it is a social phenomenon that maybe I need
to... What did they do? Did they go on the internet and find a Paul lookalike and hire him? I mean, come on.
I've been a contest winner. Right.
Yeah. No, one other thing. Sorry to interrupt you, but I was fortunate enough to go and see Paul a few weeks ago in San Diego at Petco Stadium. And I went backstage to say hello, and we had a long conversation. And I'm going to ask you a question and see if you can answer this. So I said to Paul, when I traveled with you in 1964, you had Mal Evans and Neil Aspinall, your two road managers, with you, carrying the drumsticks and, you know, doing that. So I said, how many people do you have on your tours now to help you? And see if you can come up, take a guess at the number, Robert.
Oh, I have no idea, but the crews have exponentially gotten so much bigger over time. And, you know, lighting rigs and the sound enforcement and whatever effects they use during the show. Because if you're going to do Live and Let Die, of course, you have explosions. And so you need
pyrotechnic
people. Yeah. So it's gotten to be.
You're heading to the right answer. You summed it up perfectly. I'll put you out of your misery if it is misery. Paul said that we have 90 full-time people working on the show. And 90. And instead of them traveling in Neil and Mal's old beaten up old van, they came back from South America a few months ago. They travel in one jumbo jet and sometimes two jumbo jets because, I mean, it's amazing. This is what he said. And so they've got all the equipment that you so perceptibly noted. I mean, when they get to Argentina or somewhere else, you better have the right equipment. You can't go out and rent it. So they travel in one jumbo jet and sometimes two. At times, they are a-changing.
Right. Wow. It's interesting to have it pegged to a number like that, because I would have no way of guessing, but I knew it had to be in dozens and dozens. So that's pretty amazing. Yeah. Well, good for him. And I'm glad that he brought back live horns.
Yes. And the other thing is, I must tell you this if we have a moment.
Oh, we do.
So I said, you know, you performed for 27 minutes, Paul, back in 64, 28 minutes if we were lucky. How long are you going to do? Is it going to be longer than that? And he said, wait and see, wait and see. And of course, I'm sure you know that Paul performs for 3 hours, nonstop, doesn't leave the stage, and does about 38 songs. So you pay your money, and you pay a lot of money, and you get your money's worth with Paul McCartney. It's a great show.
He doesn't even drink any water during his stage time.
He doesn't. It's astonishing. And he's not a young chick, is he, anymore?
No, I suppose not.
Yeah. Believe me, he's not.
You may be right, but you may be fine. You may get love, but you won't get mine, because I've got you.
So why we have you here, I have to ask. And now we've been talking about Beatle-related topics taking place in Southern California. And you were, of course, a witness to one of the most storied mythological stories, episodes in the Beatles' career, which was the meeting of the Beatles and Elvis. And we have an anthology, their descriptions of it, the three Beatles reminiscing about how it all went down in complete disagreement with each other and how it all happened.
I mean, it was Elvis. He just looked like Elvis.
He was the king, wasn't he? It was Elvis.
This is Mr. Hips, you know. Hip swiveling man.
Wow, you know, that's Elvis. And he was playing Mulhurst Sam all evening. He had it on jukebox. He just played it like endlessly. That was like the record of the moment for him. So it was great to see, he's a music fan. You know, he's not just, because that was one of our big records at the moment too.
He had a TV going all the time, which is what I do anyway. And in front of the TV, he had a massive big bass amplifier, Fender bass amplifier, or just a Fender amplifier. And it was a bass with a bass plugged in it. And he's up playing bass all the time with the picture up on the TV. So we just got in there and played with him, you know. We all plugged in what was ever around, and we all played and sang.
I never jammed with Elvis at all.
No. John said he'd do that on the
John
interview.
Jammed with Elvis.
Yeah, it must have been
he
when
used to
we
go
went out of the room.
Secretly at night.
I think it was because he had a bass there. You know, so I thought...
The basement.
Right, well, you know, bass, hey, he's
Ringo
interested in bass.
Ringo was playing football with him there.
Yeah, I play football with Elvis.
You know I can be found sitting home all alone. If you can't come around, at least please tell the phone. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. Baby, if I made you mad for something I might have said, please don't forget my past. The future looks bright ahead.
Elvis's people have told, given their accounts of it, but you were there. You were the professional journalist. You were the trained observer. How would you describe the whole thing? What was your take on it, and how did it roll out to you?
Well, it's interesting. I did read all these citations that you just mentioned, and as years go by, the Beatles in the anthology made it sound more kind of exciting and refreshing and dazzling than it really was in reality, because time marches on, and they're not going to say it was a bloody bore with Elvis. But to be honest with you, for the first 20 minutes, it was a bloody bore, because we walked in the house, the Beatles had been smoking in the limousine and they were all a bit stoned to start with. So they get to Elvis's house and there's Priscilla and Elvis's Memphis Mafia and Elvis sitting there like a stranger. And Elvis was not a warm person to those he didn't know. And Elvis, of course, was a bit jealous that the Beatles had usurped him from the number one spot. So for the first 15 to 20 minutes, there was an uncomfortable gathering. And the other thing that I always remember is that nobody said, Elvis, I wanted you to meet Paul, John, Ringo, and the other guy, whatever his name was. Nobody did the introduction. So they sat around for 15 minutes in an uncomfortable, I mean, just not even conversing. And finally, I give it to Elvis. He stood up and said, look, didn't you guys come here to jam or play music? And that kind of broke the air, if you like. And then the Beatles grabbed the guitars and poor old Ringo went in the other room to play Paul. And then they started strumming. And so that warmed the air. So when they left immediately, they weren't that impressed with Elvis. And then, of course, when the anthology came along, they started adding a little bit more honey to the mix. But believe me, having been there and seen it, it was awkward for 20 to 30 minutes, and then things warmed up a bit. As I say, nobody was a master of ceremonies, and that's what they needed, somebody to bring them together. Come together. Oh, sorry, sorry about that. Pardon me for my pathetic singing.
It sounds like a standoff.
Yeah. That was it.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's so funny that nobody was there to serve that role, not even Colonel Parker or Brian.
No, because Colonel Parker and Brian were in the other room smoking cigars and talking to each other, because don't forget, they knew each other a bit better. They had met and lunched at the Beverly Hills Hotel when Brian came over. They were friendly, but nobody was the designated host. And Elvis was awkward, and the Beatles were in his house surrounded by his Memphis Mafia. You could have cut the atmosphere with a knife. It was like that until Elvis made that joke and they kind of loosened up. But it wasn't Churchill and Roosevelt and Stalin, believe me.
Delta, yeah. So was there singing going on or was it just instrumental jamming?
It was just total instrumental, no singing at all, just instrumental. And Elvis led the pack with a few of the songs, but there was not one single Beatles song. It was all Elvis songs and a lot of some of the black rhythm and blues music. But Elvis didn't touch the Beatles songs, and I'm sure he knew them. The bottom line is that when they finally left, one of the Memphis Mafia, and I forget the guy's name, said, hey, Elvis loved his time with you. We must get together again. And the Beatles said, sure. But they never did get together again after that momentous or unmomentous gathering in Bel Air. And the other footnote to this is that years later, Ringo was very aggravated when Elvis told Richard Nixon that the Beatles were bums and they took American money, went back to England with their American earned money and badmouthed America. Well, of course, that was total fiction. And Mr. Presley told Mr. Nixon in the White House that silly, exaggerated statement in order to endear himself to Nixon. So Elvis lied about the Beatles, and the Beatles never forgave him for that.
Right. Well, he would have found receptive ears.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, let's close then. The other story I'd mentioned at the beginning of the show that I think it's just amazing that people will be listening to this and thinking, this man witnessed all this. Well, yeah, you did. And that was the occasion at the hotel in New York City when Bob Dylan came to visit them on their first tour. Can you describe that scene?
Well, what had happened was John was a great fan of Bob Dylan. He loved his music. And so they had been trying to get together with Dylan. And what finally happened was, and I saw this, I saw Dylan show up. I saw this kind of scruffy guy with a backpack walk through the corridors and come into the suite where the Beatles were. And when he got there, he took out some good weed and he handed it around. And they closed the door and they put a few wet towels along the door so that the odor did not escape. And he gave them terrific high-grade marijuana, a cigarette that was like a cigar. And he gave it to Ringo, and they all sat around, and Ringo actually smoked the whole damn cigarette. And then they said, but Ringo, you're supposed to take two puffs and pass it around. Well, apparently Ringo did not know what the decorum was, what the routine was. And Ringo was right away rolling on the floor, giggling. But then they ended up smoking other pot, good quality pot, that Mr. Dylan had provided them. And they all ended up in various states of, excitement, including Brian Epstein and the other Beatles. And finally, when the door was open, I was there, the sort of a cloud of marijuana smoke engulfed me, and the Beatles were just all over the place. And Dylan then got his backpack and off he went, having introduced them to fine quality marijuana. That was it, basically. And then the Beatles went on to enjoy marijuana by themselves and also to enjoy other chemical inducements.
So you're there watching this unfold. Now,
but I mean, the point is, when the door opened, it was like somebody had felled them. I mean, there were Beatles on the floor, Beatles giggling, cloud of smoke that enveloped us, and everybody kind of staggered out the room, quite happy, but certainly heavily under the influence of Bob Dylan's gift to them.
And during the time they're in there, you're in the outer room where there's drinks are being served and it's sort of a gathering for the press.
It was the last night of the tour, hungover. We all got up and we went to see the Beatles off at Idlewild Airport, and they staggered on the plane and they were heading back to England.
Now, I have to think that given that you're a journalist and you're witnessing this stuff, and God knows what else you've been witnessing when accompanying the Beatles on tour, that there's this sort of tacit understanding and what you're going to report that is sort of implicit given your access.
Well, you're absolutely right. And we knew this. It was an understanding. It's not as if we signed one of those disclosure agreements, believe me, but we knew that we were part of the Beatles family, and that whenever we saw, or I saw, hanky-panky going on, the term hanky-panky can cover all sorts of sins and fun. Whenever I saw that going on, I knew, first of all, my paper didn't want that. In 2019, if hanky-panky was going on with me traveling with a pop group, 3 minutes of iPhone film would have been on the internet within 50 seconds. But we knew. That if we wrote negative stories about the boys, that Brian, who paid attention to these things because he did not want the Beatles' image to be tarnished in any way, Brian would have said, "You're no longer on our private jet, Ivor. See you tomorrow. Off you go." And so we felt we were kind of co-conspirators in this whole thing. And we enjoyed being on the inside of what was going on. And we knew that, we talked about the riots in New Orleans on the field and about the crazy girls. But we didn't talk about extracurricular activities with the Beatles, because I don't know whether the paper would have run it for fear of a lawsuit. But certainly, being a member of the family, Robert, you don't tell stories out of school about your own family, do you?
Right.
And that's the way we felt. Mm-hmm. We felt that, yeah.
But do you think that mindset changed over the course of the decade? Because it seems like by 67, when you've got News of the World participating with the police in the drug busts of the Rolling Stones and activity like that, it seemed like at some point the old school rules got thrown out the window and you did start playing that gotcha game.
They did. But you've got to realize, Robert, the source of these stories, these scandalous stories, was in a newspaper called the News of the World, which was later to be owned by Mr. Rupert Murdoch. And the News of the World thrived on the scandal. The News of the World, people read it, and I think I mentioned in my book, everybody called it the barmaid's Bible, because you could pick up stories about famous people. It was kind of the National Enquirer before the National Enquirer. And so the News of the World, which was a mass selling London Sunday newspaper, had all these scandal stories on Sunday, which we all read and we devoured ravenously, because it was all the gossip and all the stuff that nobody else would write about. So I don't know. I mean, look at it today. Would you tell me, I'll just jump back, in early Hollywood, Confidential magazine did the same. All the scandal stories about Rock Hudson and what have you. Today, I'll ask you this. Is TMZ, the News of the World, the New National Enquirer, who runs the scandal stories today.
Right. You've got that kind of gossip trade going out there, and it always has been, I guess.
Yeah.
But you make the distinction between the serious journalism that you guys were doing versus the stuff that was sort of, as you say, devoured by a certain segment of the public. But definitely, these were not outlets that were getting access to the Beatles or anybody else.
No, they were not. And, you know, Brian was such a protector of the Beatles, you can't believe it. He used to sit or stand every press conference at every stop and listen to them. And if John, for example, spoke with a cigarette in his mouth or did something mildly non-permissible, at the end of it, Brian would rush up to John and give him a lecture, say, next time, don't do this, don't do that. So he was aware of the proclivities and the things that the Beatles did. Because don't forget, Brian was the one that got them to Ed Sullivan's show, and he was the one that took them to America. And he did not want anything the Beatles did to destroy the myth. And Brian, of course, as all of your listeners, all your Beatle passionate fans know, Brian cleaned them up and did all that stuff and stopped them smoking. I mean, I was having a conversation with Angie McCartney, Paul McCartney's stepmom, and she told me the same thing. I mean, Brian was like their rabbi, their priest, and he tried to crack the whip on them. Of course, Brian had his own personal demons, but that is, as they say, another story for another episode.
And on that note, we'll conclude this episode, this visit with Ivor Davis, who's got this terrific new Manson book out, which is very timely on the 50th of the things going on, as well as the new Tarantino film. And the earlier The Beatles and Me on Tour, discussing the earlier mid-60s Beatle tours and American anecdotes and stories. So thank you once again, Ivor. It's so great to have you on the show. So great to get these stories from a living witness out into the public.
Robert, thank you. And it's always a pleasure to talk to you, because you are so damn savvy about it. You remind me of things I don't know and don't remember. So thanks for the conversation.
They said they would. They stone you when you're trying to go home. They'll stone you when you're there all alone. But I would not feel so all alone. Everybody must get stoned. Well, they'll stone you when you're walking on the street. They'll stone your seat. They'll stone you when you're walking on the floor. They'll stone you when you're walking to the door. But I would not feel so all alone. Everybody must get stoned.
Something About the Beatles, created and hosted by Robert Rodriguez, executive producer Rick Way, title song by The Corgis.
Song Charles Manson stole from the Beatles. We're stealing it back.
I got blisters. I got blisters. I got blisters.
Christmas light.